From the City Opera House, welcome to the second program of the 2011 Traverse City National Writers Series. This evening's special guest is author Sarah Brokaw, the daughter of legendary news anchor Tom Brokaw. A licensed therapist with a practice in Beverly Hills, California, Brokaw is the author of Fortitude, Making the Next Decades the Best Years of Your Life, through the 40s, 50s, and beyond. The house lights have dimmed. Megan Raphael, the moderator of tonight's program, is on stage preparing to welcome Sarah Brokaw.
Hello, good evening. We are truly lucky to have Sarah Brokaw with us tonight. You may have seen some of her national media that she was on. She was on Today Show, the Morning Joe Show. She was featured in USA Today, and as someone said, she's come straight from New York City to Traverse City. So we are truly thrilled that she's here. It's the beginning of a huge book tour for her, and we are so delighted to have her here. She has, as I've come to know through her book and through conversations we've had over the last couple days, she has such depth and wisdom. You're just going to really get a lot of insights. One of the things you'll find out about her is she is incredibly petite, and she has this mighty, mighty passion for what she does. So it's a great combination. By trade, she's a psychotherapist, and she's a certified life coach. She lives in Santa Monica and California now. She grew up primarily in New York. She came bundled up. She brought her New York wardrobe, so she's very warm. She came in with a down jacket, which was great. She loves searching, and surfing. It reminded me of the Beach Boys' California Dreaming song, because as a Midwestern girl growing up with that song, I always wanted to be a California girl. Well, I think we have one in here in Sarah. She's a world traveler. She's a really well-renowned philanthropist, and she's worked with a lot of international women's organizations, which we'll talk about tonight. It seems to be a real passion for her, and she's traveled all over the world with that. Her book is terrific, and I always look for great books with great titles, and Fortitude is truly a great title. And most important, I think, as I've read the book and as I've talked to her, she is truly a change master. She's really helping women and anyone who reads her book in truth, men or women, to really make changes from the inside out, and that's really where change comes from. So with that, I'll just introduce, and if you'd join me in a round of applause to welcome Sarah. Hi. Yep, you sit there. Hi there.
Hi there. Hi, everyone. I love Traverse City, by the way.
It's fun,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Beautiful.
It's great. Well, you mentioned that when you came from New York that you flew over all the woods. It was such a relief to
just be able to see some trees. Uh-huh. Green.
Lovely.
Green.
Lovely. And well, and you love water, and so I can imagine how beautiful did you see the bay coming in?
Of course. And I also saw Lake Michigan, which I've never seen before. Oh, it's just stunning. You guys are very lucky.
You have the ocean, but we have Lake Michigan.
Yes, exactly.
So, one of the things I want to start with, I want to talk certainly about your book and some mm-hmm. of the philanthropic work you've done, but I really would like to start the conversation with talking about you personally so that we can all get to know you a little bit better. Mm-hmm. In your book, you're very honest about your life, your family, your concerns about your own aging. So I thought maybe we could just start with a question. And I know I vowed I wasn't going to ask you this, but I suspect it's on everybody's mind, mm-hmm. which is, what was it like growing up with such a famous father as Tom Brokaw?
I think it's a very good question, and I think that it's okay to ask that question as well. Well, I have to say, you guys, that if you see what's happening with Charlie Sheen, obviously everyone is well aware of what's happening there. And I think about those poor children and thinking about having a father who's so incredibly narcissistic and unstable. And my heart breaks for those children. And I have to say that I never had that type of experience. My father was pretty amazing considering the circumstances. He was tough, and there were times where I, being the typical adolescent, hated him, didn't want to listen to anything that he had to tell me. But at the end of the day, I have to give him so much credit for setting such high standards for his three daughters and having expectations that he felt that we could meet. At that time, there was no way I could understand where he was coming from. But in retrospect, I would definitely say I really, really appreciate the way that he had fathered me and my two sisters.
Right. And you do have, you have two older sisters?
Correct.
You're the youngest, you're the baby.
That's right.
And you've spoken a lot about your mom in the book. You talked about her, her accomplishments. She is quite a horse rider. You mentioned that she, and you described her as having the even keel. She was
She's
even keel?
She's the even keel person of her family, absolutely. I can't say enough about my mom. She and I have a very tight relationship. We can't be more different from each other. She is able to have a conversation with every person in the room and remain calm, and everyone calls her the Queen of Grace. I've never been called the Queen of Grace. I'm trying to figure out how I can become the Queen of Grace, but I don't think that's going to happen. But my mother is, you know, pretty a terrific woman. I think if you have to imagine that when she married my father, she was taking a big risk, not because she thought he was going to be well known, but because he was a troublemaker. Everyone said, "What is Meredith Hall doing with Tom Brokaw?" And but she did take that risk. There was a part of her that recognized that this man was pretty special. Of course, you know, his career just took off, and then they had three kids, and then they moved to New York City. And I think, and there were so many young women who had crushes on my dad and continued to have crushes on him. And my mom just kept her cool. Kept her cool to the point where my dad and I have this joke, we call her Planet Meredith. It's so hard to find her. We're orbiting around her trying to find her.
So she really is the hub of your family.
She really is. She really is pretty dynamic.
How has she impacted you the most?
How's my mother?
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's my mother does not have tolerance for self-pitying. She really doesn't. There was one day, and this was mentioned in USA Today, and this is no joke. I think it was around 10 years ago, and I was just sitting there feeling sorry for myself. I'm like, my sisters are married, and I don't have a boyfriend, and they have kids, and I don't have kids. And my mother just rolled her eyes at me and said, "What are you doing?" She said, "You have a tremendous amount of strength. Capitalize on that strength and marry forth." And that shut me right up. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, all right, Meredith is right. And I really had to take her advice. But she's been like that through my entire life.
So she's a real champion of you, but she also encourages
you
to keep going. And
absolutely, absolutely. You know, and of course, once again, there are moments where I wish that she could be a little bit more emotional, you know, because I'm a pretty emotional person. But at the same time, I think that it's been really important to have a mother to have the silent strength. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important, really, really important. And not to allow her daughters to victimize themselves. One thing I also think that my mother had done, she never, ever talked about our looks. She never talked about our weight. She never focused on that. She was so conscientious about thinking about what our internal strengths were, which was amazing. So we never really had to think about how we appeared, our image, how our image looked to other people. What was most important was what our internal beauty had to offer.
And that's truly what you've done in your book and encourages.
You.
So that's
I
a wonderful
like
learning.
That. Thanks.
You're welcome. I thought one of the things I was struck with, because I found it when I, the same was true when I interviewed some of the women for my book, that your mom, when you interviewed her, and she is in the book, about her accomplishments. She is very accomplished, but she didn't see it as such. She was just going to be, you know, she didn't see herself like that. And I noticed when I talk to women about their courage, most women just don't acknowledge that. So
it's so true. She doesn't see it that. She just sees it. Someone had asked her a question, which is, when does life begin? When did your life begin? And she goes, well, what do you mean? Life was always happening. It's just that every moment in our life can be a beginning, it can be the end, it can be the middle. But the bottom line is just that life is just an evolution. Life doesn't just start at some point, it ends at some point. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also a message that she had given me, which was that take advantage of every moment. It doesn't just start here, and it doesn't just end here.
Mm-hmm. And you do say that. I mean, that is a theme that kind of weaves its way through your book, isn't
that's
it?
That's right.
To really start recreating it in every moment based on what you want. I thought it was interesting in the book. You say in the book that you consider yourself the imperfect person in your family. You had scoliosis, as I understand. You wore back braces.
40 degrees.
I
had 40-degree scoliosis,
and you wore
like this. So I have an S-curve.
Wow. And you wore a back brace.
23 hours a day for 3 years in a row.
Oh, my.
From 7th grade through 10th grade.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So you chose a different path. You said you went into psychology versus a more traditional path. It sounded like maybe your parents would have preferred that you maybe perhaps went into business or as you say, more traditional. And in your book, you have a quote, "I have known for a long time that I didn't have it in me to follow the traditional path." And so I'm curious, how did you find the courage to stay true to your non-traditional path in kind of a traditional family?
Right. Once again, I think that I didn't recognize it as courage. I think that it was, if I can be so honest, I think it's when I graduated from college and there was a moment, I think I was 23 years old, and I didn't know exactly what I was going to do with my life, and I was at such a loss, and my eldest sister was an MD, she was an ER physician, and my other sister was a rock and roll star. I mean, she was doing A&R for a rock and roll music company in Los Angeles, and my dad was at the top of the Nielsen ratings, and my mother was becoming this avid horseback rider. And there I was, I gained like 30 pounds and just feeling awful, and I had a panic attack.
Oh, boy.
And I thought, oh my God, who am I? I thought I was dying. I thought my lung collapsed. And I told my sister's like, "You're just having a panic attack. That's all you're having." I'm like, "No, I'm not.
I'm dying."
And so she said, "No, you really are. That's all what's happening here." I'm like, "I'm really dying. I gotta go to the ER." So she took me to the physician. The physician's like, "Yes, you're having a panic attack. Don't worry about it." So he gave me Valium, which was awful because it just made me spacey.
Oh dear.
Right? But I took it. And then I think it was 2 months later where I wasn't feeling better, and I called my sister, the ER physician. And I described what I was feeling, and she said, "You know what? You're just going through post-college depression. That's all you're doing. And I think that it's okay to go through it. You need to see a therapist." And I said, "Well, how am I going to find a therapist? Mom and Dad are not going to approve." Because, you know, they're from South Dakota. Mm-hmm. They're of that generation where if you have time to brood, you should be out tending to your garden. Mm-hmm. You can't sit there and talk.
Yeah.
So what I did was, I love how everyone's laughing because they can totally understand where my parents are coming from. So I called a family friend and I went to see a therapist, and it changed my life. Not only was I able to gain, you know, clarity about who I was as an individual who had just graduated from college, but I discovered that I loved the idea of psychotherapy. And I think I always had an insatiable curiosity about people and the human mind. But knowing that I could actually talk about it in a room with someone for 50 minutes one time a day, it was amazing. Mm. The hardest part for me was to tell my parents, because I didn't have an income, to give them the bill and say, "You got to pay for my therapy," you know. And of course, my dad begrudgingly in the beginning was like, "Oh, well, you're just going to a talk doctor. That's all you're doing, Sarah. You know, you're just going to see someone for a few weeks, right? And that's it." And when I told him, I said, "Not only do I love therapy and being a patient or a client, I want to become a psychotherapist." You know, you think, "Oh Christ," you know, but but it turned out to be obviously a wonderful path. And I think that now my parents still have trouble understanding what therapy really is. Mm-hmm. And also, you can see the shows that are out there and how therapists are represented. These actresses are representing as therapists, or actors representing as therapists. That they still feel like it's a little bit of an indulgence, mm-hmm. you know, and I had to understand that and appreciate it because they are of that generation and they are from the Midwest. But I think overall they can it's true, sorry guys. I'm from New York City, so, but you know, I think that they do have a much greater appreciation of therapy because they've seen how I've used it. Mm-hmm. And how important it has been in our country. Mm-hmm. So I think that they've been able to back off and look at me now a little bit more with admiration, mm-hmm. which I really agree. I like that. Yeah. It feels pretty good.
Yeah, it helps even though you've chosen that path and you would have done it regardless of that. You still, it feels good to continue.
Absolutely.
On that way.
Absolutely.
That's great. So maybe it's time to talk about your book a little bit.
Sure.
I'm curious about what inspired you to write your book.
I think that there were actually it was two parallel, there was a parallel experience that I was having with the experiences that my clients in my private practice were having. Now, at the time that I was thinking about writing this book, I was living in New York City. I was not in Santa Monica. And I had a very successful practice. I had a number of women coming in to see me, and these women were between the ages of, say, 35 and 42. And the reasons were different for coming in to see me, but the common denominator was the fear of aging, hitting the big 4-0 or reaching the big 4-0 and thinking, who am I, what am I, what is my life about? I had one woman who actually was 37 years of age. She was married at the age of 23. She had three kids. She suddenly wanted to have an affair at 37. And I thought, why would you want to do that? Really, it's so destructive. Why would you want to do that? And after seeing her for several sessions, she finally admitted to me, she said, because I'm no longer going to be sexy when I hit 40, and I feel like this is my time to prove that I'm sexually desirable. And I said, well, then just go to like a pole dancing class to prove how sexy you are. So, you know, so it was really interesting, but she did. She went to a pole dancing class. She didn't
did
have
that
an
help?
Affair. Yeah, it helped. She didn't have an affair, and she started to laugh at herself. She's like, God, what is wrong with me? I'm like, it's not you. It's how society looks at women in their mid-30s. Mm-hmm. Then there was another woman who was 41 years of age. She had done extraordinarily well for herself. She carved out a great path. She became managing director of a corporation. Mm-hmm. And she had come to me originally because she was having some issues with, you know, some colleagues. But then there was one night she came to me, and she obviously was crying for several hours. She just had the red nose and the red eyes, and she just sat down, and she said, who am I? What am I? I know I make this amount of money, but I don't have a partner, and I don't have kids, and I don't know where my life is going to end up. And it was at that moment I thought, this is really interesting that these women are starting to come. I could provide you with more examples, but I think you guys get an understanding about the women who were coming to see me and what they were feeling. Right at that moment was my 20th high school year reunion. Now, with my personality as a psychotherapist, I'm pretty tough. I'm really direct. I kind of take on that Midwestern approach. I'm like, buck up and go forth. So, which I think my clients appreciate, but I obviously was not heeding my own advice when the 20th high school year reunion occurred. I chose not to go. I kept my hands over my eyes, and I thought, I'm not married, I don't have kids, all my friends were married. Even the people I thought would never got married, you know? I mean, I just remember this guy named Jeremy Feinberg. I'm like, how did he get married? But he got married, you know? And a lot of the women who had children, and I just remember thinking, I am not going. And I got a lot of calls from students who called and said, well, now, Sarah Brokaw, why didn't you go? And I was too embarrassed to tell them, because I'm a loser and I don't have a husband and I don't
want you to know anything about me.
Exactly. And that's when I thought, God, I'm such a hypocrite. I really need to understand and appreciate that I'm accomplished in so many other areas in my life. Mm-hmm. And that I don't need to feel accomplished because I've reached that traditional milestone of getting married and having children. And then that's when I decided to take that moment of crisis and convert it into a sparkling moment. And I thought, well, I need to figure out if other women across the nation are experiencing what I'm experiencing and what these women are experiencing in my practice. Mm-hmm. Is this an urban dilemma? Is this a New York City dilemma? Mm-hmm. Or is this something that a lot of women, as I said, across the nation are experiencing? So I made it my mission to travel for a year and a half to various parts of the country. I first started off in Darien, Connecticut, and then I would go to New York City, then Oxford, Mississippi, Memphis, Tennessee, Provo, Utah, Bozeman, Montana, San Francisco, Chicago, Illinois, Dallas, Texas, Seattle, San Francisco. And I facilitated these discussion groups with over 300 women.
Wow.
If I may just lead into the next question that you may ask, which is that a lot of people say, well, how did you break, you know, the ice with all these women from all walks of life? That would be pretty difficult. And I have to say that, yes, I thought that I could really break the ice by just being myself and asking some questions, but that doesn't work that way. You know, a lot of women were very reluctant to be in that type of setting to reveal their deepest, darkest secrets or even just express their thoughts. So I thought that the biggest icebreaker would be to give them an exercise. Mm. And the exercise was a list of 20 values. And I had the women take the time to circle the top five values that they really want to use as their guiding principles. And I said to them, I said, the caveat is that the minute you hear someone else's voice other than your own, mm-hmm. I don't want you to choose that value. I really want you to do this when you listen to your own voice. So they did, and they followed through with the exercise. And I have to say that on average, the same five values kept coming up. And I thought, that's it. These are the five values that we women and men out there, men, need to really incorporate as our guiding principles. And that's how I chose those five values that I discuss in my book.
From the City Opera House, you are listening to the Traverse City National Writers Series. Tonight's special guest is Sarah Brokaw, author of Fortitude, Making the Next Decades the Best Years of Your Life. This is Interlochen Public Radio.
With just the title and what you've kind of the whole piece of it, the whole summary, if you have those five values, and we'll come to the five values about fortitude. Mm-hmm. Because I found that it was really interesting as I read it, and you certainly talk about 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, and as I approach my 60th very quickly, I still found a lot of insights. So talk about what fortitude means to you.
I think fortitude really means, if in just one sentence, how I personally define it, is about, once again, removing your hands from your eyes and looking at life through the lens of curiosity rather than through the lens of fear. I think it's so essential for us to all do that. I really do. So fortitude, once again, is looking through the lens of curiosity and courage rather than through the lens of fear and regret. That's how I would define it. I also have to say that I can't give myself the credit for this quote, but someone had given it to me, and I think it's another way to describe fortitude, which is when we recognize that change is inevitable, growth is optional, and we need to choose wisely. Mm. And I thought that's so true. Mm-hmm. It's so well put.
So it's really a choice, and that's what you talk about throughout
Absolutely.
Your book.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the values. Want to name them first, then we can maybe
Grace,
go through them. Grace.
Connectedness. Accomplishment without the monetary, materialistic, or traditional milestones, adventure, and spirituality.
Mm. And they're great as I read through them. I mean, you put some little different twists on each one of them.
Yeah.
Let's start with grace, because you said in the book that you often use a metaphor to describe what you're talking about when you refer to grace.
The metaphor with driving the car?
Yes. So maybe you can just share that to really kind of explain what you
Absolutely.
Mean by grace.
Absolutely. I also believe that I use metaphors all the time because I feel like it simplifies everything in a way. And I also think that adds more dimension. It really helps a person understand what they're experiencing at that moment. And I think that the way I look at it is that life is like you're driving in your car and you're in the fast lane, you're going 65 miles per hour, and all of a sudden someone is right in front of you and there was like a roadblock and they stop, and also you're like, oh God, and you can either be there white knuckled, saying, I can't believe this is happening, and you get really stressed and you're really angry, or you have the option of saying, this is going to happen, I'm going to just take a deep breath and just go with the flow. Now, admittedly, there are times when I experience road rage on the 405, and I'm so angry there's so
much
traffic.
And understandably so, yes.
Right, but at the same time, there are moments where I'm like, okay, this is a metaphor for life. How do I just sit back and just take it all in? And I think the grace factor is about letting things come to you, recognize that these events are inevitable, the good events, the bad events, the shocking events, and responding to these events with equanimity. And I also think with a sense of humility as well, is how I would describe grace.
Great. Yeah, I really love that metaphor when I read that. And in the chapter on grace, you say that it's time for us to reclaim our beauty. What do you mean by that? How would we do that? How would women reclaim their beauty in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s?
I think reclaiming your beauty, it's about capitalizing on what we have. I think that we all focus so much on what we don't have. And, you know, once again, if I may say, and I'm not here to toot my own horn, I really am not, but I feel like the research is me search. And when I was younger, I could have sat there and felt sorry for myself about my curvature. I mean, how embarrassing is it to be an adolescent to wear a brace for 23 hours a day? But I was determined to prove to myself that I was an incredible athlete. And I've done that for several years, and I started to get into triathlons, and I made sure that I could place in the top five. You know, that to me was really important. That to me is proving that inevitably we're going to age and we may lose the suppleness that we all hold on to dearly. We can do that and be upset, or we can really take a look at ourselves and say, I am so happy that I've got my legs, I got my arms, I've got my hair, I got my boobs, I can function. And I'm pretty damn proud of that. And I think that we are a society that can be so driven by external beauty. You know, I'm one of those, absolutely, but I also think there are moments where we've got to stop.
Yeah.
We have to stop that, especially when you look at women who had no choice but to have a double mastectomy and have chemotherapy because they've been diagnosed with breast cancer. And I would imagine that most of you guys have known someone who's been diagnosed with breast cancer who had to go through a round of chemo. Now, they, of course, are forced to think about their own beauty, losing their hair, having a double mastectomy. Now, talk about losing your femininity. And the women who I've met who've been able to not only defeat breast cancer, but to walk out on the other side and think, I'm the most beautiful person around.
Yeah, it's pretty.
That's reclaiming your beauty.
And you use several examples of or stories from women who have had breast cancer in your book, don't you?
Oh yeah, they're amazing to me.
Yeah, yeah, and it seemed like you've learned a lot from them.
Oh
as
yeah,
they've talked about
it
that.
Was humbling.
How about connectedness? You know, you could probably, if when we turn up the lights, you'll see lots of groups of women sitting together here. You address the issue of female friendships and how important they are to our fortitude. You use the word nourishment, that they nourish us. How do they nourish us, and how do your women friends nourish you?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think, well, one thing I did bring up in the book, which is that for all the clients who have come to see me, their complaints really entail like their relationships with their spouses, children acting out at school, not being happy in the workplace, being unemployed or just being fired. But I've never heard any of my clients, both men and women, complain about their friendships.
True, that's true in my coaching practice too.
Right?
You're absolutely right, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, so I thought, well, that's interesting. What is it about friendships that we never really complain about? We may get mad at our friends, or we may be disappointed, or you know, that's part
of connection with them.
Exactly, or, that's what happens. But I realize that friendships are so much more. I can't exactly describe it in words, but the feeling that I get is feeling safe. It's a sense of just feeling at peace with my friends because they know me. And I know that no matter what, they've got my back. No matter what. They're not there to judge me. They are there to be on my team. And it doesn't mean that my family can't do that, but there's obviously a different dynamic that you have with your family versus what you have with your friends. And I think that what I've also noticed, someone said something also very interesting, Nora Ephron. I don't know if you guys know Nora Ephron, but she said you could always tell the quality of a woman through the longevity of her friendships. And it's so true. It's so true. And my mother being one of them, she's maintained friendships with her friends for over 20 years. And she now has a really wonderful group of female friends, and they call themselves the Whistle Creek Women. And they gather together on an annual basis, and they get on their horses, and they go up into the mountains, and they're there for two nights, and they come back. And my mom is 70 years old, and every single time she's come back for the past 8 years, she said, I can't wait to do this when I'm in my 80s. And they tell each other secrets that their spouses don't know about, and it drives my dad crazy. He's like, what are they talking about? You know, and she won't say a thing. And that, to me, is a wonderful example mm-hmm. of how powerful friendships are.
Mm-hmm. And how they can keep you moving forward, their stability.
Oh, yeah. How many times have, you know, you sat and just thought about something to the point where you start perseverating?
Oh, yeah.
And you have a friend who's like, knock it off. Get over it. Move on. You know, and we need that.
Yep, we absolutely do. Honest opinions about things.
Oh, yes.
Exactly.
For sure.
So I want to talk just a bit about the value of accomplishment. You say that a core question for women is about accomplishment, and the real question is, how do we learn to appreciate that we are good enough just as we are without compromising our standards in terms of what we want to achieve in life? And you talk about the societal expectations that women have to either do, be, or how we do what we do have in order to deem ourselves good enough. Mm-hmm. So how can women do this and push aside that voice that says, you're not good enough?
I think it starts right now. I think it's really our responsibilities, mm-hmm. Megan, and I think that it's the women out there and also the men to recognize that we are good enough. Mm-hmm. And I think that we also need to teach that to younger women out there as well. Mm-hmm. I think that if I can just connectedness for just 1 second, mm-hmm. which is about the role of mentors. I think that it's our job right now as women who hit our 30s and 40s, 50s and 60s mm-hmm. to tell women that they are good enough. Mm-hmm. It's so important. Mm-hmm. There are so many younger women, and you guys would know this, that they really have such a difficult time in not comparing themselves to others. Mm-hmm. It's the compare and despair.
I was going to say, you use that phrase, compare and despair.
Yes, and men do the same thing. But I think it happens more often with younger mm-hmm. women than mm-hmm. it does with younger men, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Personally, I think that I struggled with that my entire life. I think I've had an overachieving family, and in hindsight, I'm so glad that I felt like I had to work really hard to feel like just as accomplished. But there were moments where I really experienced self-doubt, you know, but now as I move forward and I have fortitude, that I can say that whose voice am I hearing when I don't feel accomplished? Mm-hmm. And I think that partly it was my family growing up, but they didn't really care. They were so proud of me. But it was also about I was responding directly to society's milestones that they have set for women. Mm-hmm. So that could be, you know, college, and in your 20s you explore, and then you get married, and then you have kids, and then when you have kids and you can further your career, and then you can become a grandparent. And there I was like, oh God, I'm not married and I don't have kids and I'm not accomplished. And then I just had this terrible internal dialogue with myself. And then on the other side, though, of the spectrum, when I was talking, there was one wonderful experience I had. It was a Latter-day Saint, and I would have never met her had I not had this wonderful project to work on. And she was in Orange County, and it was, you know, 20 women, and this woman kind of raised her hand, and we were talking about accomplishment. She goes, I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I'm 48 years old, and I've had 8 kids. And she never finished college because she got married, and she's so happy, and she takes pride in being a Latter-day Saint and having these children. But then she had a tear in her eye, and she goes, but I'm really upset about something. And I said, well, what is it? And she said, I never finished college, and I always thought I would be a doctor. I loved chemistry, but I didn't follow through. I became a mom. And everyone just stopped and looked at her because everyone thought that she was the mother, being a great mom of mm-hmm. 8 and being mm-hmm. a strong member of the Latter-day Saint community. And she goes, and I feel like it's just too late. I just didn't, who am I, what am I? And I said, well, I wonder what would happen if maybe you could go to a community college and just audit a chemistry class. And she thought, can I really do that? And then 3 months later, I get an email from her, and she did. She
That's
enrolled.
Great.
In a course, you know, at uh-huh. the local college, it was Saddleback College, and I thought, see?
Uh-huh.
Great. Then she really felt like there was a sense of accomplishment. Uh-huh.
You mentioned that term, it's too late. In your book, you talk about that that's one of the greatest mistakes we can make is to say it's too late about anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so is there anything that you have said it's too late and that you've gone ahead and tried?
Well, I think I try everything. Let me think for a second. I would say, personally, no. For me, no.
That would be my guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I try everything, you know, to a fault mm-hmm. sometimes. But mm-hmm. I would definitely say that there are a number of women who feel like it's been too late. You know, one woman who said, you know what, I'm a mom, I'm a working mom, and I am so out of shape, I will never get myself back into shape the way I was when I was 18 years of age. And I said, I don't believe it. We could all get ourselves back into shape. It's not too late. Mm-hmm. It is possible. It's just about becoming wiser about how you exercise. Mm-hmm. What you do when you're 18, maybe you're not going to be able to do it when you're 42 or 43, but I guarantee that you can do something.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. I'll give you another example, which was I started again to triathlons when I was 34 years old, and I thought I was a hotshot triathlete. And I was running, and I was like, God, I'm so good at this. And then all of a sudden, and we had to wear our age on the back, on our right calf. We had to put our age there. And I'm like, I'm 34, I'm hot. And then this woman whizzes past me, and on her right calf it said 51. And I'm like, wait a second, wait, that's not right. And so I found her at the end of the race. I'm like, are you kidding me? You're 51 years of age. She's like, so?
But
and
I'm 34.
She didn't get into triathlons until she was 46. So that's my, you know, I just feel like if we let that prevent us from mm-hmm. moving forward or trying new things, then we're never going to enjoy life. Mm-hmm.
And there are so many great examples of that now. Of people accomplishing things at
long
age 92 running triathlons.
Exactly.
In fact, I just read that. Was that in your book I read that?
76-year-old.
I read about a 92-year-old.
Sister Mary. No, it's a 76-year-old nurse, Sister Mary, who just finished her last Hawaii World Champion Ironman last year.
Wow, isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
So we need to pay attention to those stories to
Absolutely.
Just keep us motivated. One of the things you said under that whole value of adventure, which is what we're talking about, creating adventure in your life and newness and trying new things, mm-hmm. you had a quote, and I loved it, about your sister. You said, she has taken fear mm-hmm. and turned it into motivation to propel herself forward.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you do that? How can women do that?
Well, let me just describe my sister to you. My sister is pretty amazing. I really look up to her. She is an ER physician. She's an incredible athlete. She's an avid swimmer. She has done the Alcatraz swimming race, which you swim from Alcatraz to San Francisco, mm-hmm. and she does it without a wetsuit.
Oh,
that's incredible.
Yeah.
And I know she's so mad at me that I'm going to be revealing this, but it's okay. And she can go into the ER and put her hand into the cavity of someone's heart and resuscitate the person. But if there's a moth in the room, she has to run out, you know, or she can't be in an elevator. She is really phobic. And she didn't like these anxieties. She didn't want these anxieties to control her. And she was so mad at herself for having these anxieties that I think, and I know, that she really made it her mission to go through medical school and choose the hardest specialty where you really didn't have a choice but to challenge those anxieties. That's why she chose ER. Mm. And she's done extraordinarily well as an ER physician.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's how she dealt with it.
Mm-hmm. Once she just turned it around.
Turned it around.
Move it forward.
Absolutely. Removed her hands from her eyes.
Mm-hmm. So yet another one. And just the last one, I just wanted, because I thought this was an interesting one in terms of the values that you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
You describe what led you to appreciate the need for spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about being called into action to counsel the families of victims of September 11th.
Mm.
Can you describe that to us a bit?
Oh, you have no idea, you guys. I landed that morning at 4 in the morning from San Francisco on an American Airlines flight. Landed. My mom called at 8:45 in the morning, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't pick up the phone because I got in so late, but finally I picked up the phone, I'm like, what? And she said, New York City's under attack. and I turn on the television, and I know we all remember where we were. It's like the before 9/11 and after 9/11. We all have a clear idea where we were. And I remember turning on the television, having a very surreal moment, and just my heart sinking and not knowing what to do. And then at that moment, FEMA was contacting federal, it's a federal emergency monetary agency. They were desperately trying to find all the mental health professionals and social workers living in New York City to come down and work with the families who, and also colleagues who have lost someone in this, in the towers. So I got a call, and then I agreed to go down that day, and if I can describe it, I remember taking the taxi down, and there were people wandering around aimlessly with pictures of their loved ones, describing what they looked like and posting it up, you know, in random places, on telephone posts and on the walls of buildings. And I go downstairs. I was at the St. Vincent's Hospital, which was, what, 8 blocks away from the towers, and there was nothing but smoke still, and it had this really distinct odor. It just smelled like burnt metal. And I remember going down to the basement, it was windowless, and I sat down in a, you know, chair like this, obviously, into a table. And for 14 hours in a row, I had lines, people lined up and say, can you find this name? Let's say it's Doug Jones. And we would have to look through, and if Doug Jones' name, the list was of the people who actually survived. And who was not on that list, we would have to call the morgues. And there was this one gentleman, oh man, it still kills me just thinking about it, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, freckles, athletic, could have been my peer because I was 31 years old, sat down, and he just sat there and he said, this is so weird, I just talked to my brother today, and he just wasn't really making sense. And I had asked him, I said, well, where was your brother? He said, Cantor Fitzgerald. And we all know that Cantor Fitzgerald employees were on the 110th floor. Mm-hmm. And I knew right at that point that his brother had died. Mm-hmm. And he said, I just think he's dead. I think he's dead. And before that very moment, I really didn't, it's not that I didn't have a spiritual belief, but I just didn't understand how spirituality played a role in my life. And I looked at this guy, and his hands were shaking, and I gave him a granola bar because I didn't know what else to do. And I said, well, just maybe you need to eat. And so he couldn't even open up the granola bar because he was so distraught, and his hands were shaking. So I had opened up for him, and I had asked him, I said, well, do you go to church? And he said, I do. He was Catholic. And I said, I think you need to go to church and just pray for your brother. And that was it. I thought, oh, I get it. I can see how spirituality does play a role in people's lives. Mm-hmm. I may not choose religion as a way to be spiritual, but I could see the importance of it mm-hmm. right at that moment.
Mm-hmm. And how does spirituality show up in your life now?
When I'm on a surfboard and I'm out there and nothing matters. Mm-hmm. All what matters is the wave coming in. Mm-hmm. And thinking, am I going to live this or am I not going to live this? Am I going to, you know, get pummeled or am I going to look like a hot shot? You know, but it is that moment of, I don't know if anyone has surfed here, but you just, the energy that comes, you know, that just right over your head. And it's so amazing to get on a board and you're kind of floating on water. I mean, that's just, that's spiritual. Mm-hmm. I can't really describe it once again in words. I'm not giving it justice. I think that everyone out there needs to just go and try it and experience it and have that moment. There was a woman who I talked to today, and she gets it. You just, it's just incredible.
Because you talk about spirituality as finding inner peace, and so it sounds like
it's an inner peace. You can see, I'm smiling from ear to ear. Yeah. I just love it.
I can't wait
to get back out there because nothing will matter once I get on that board. Nothing. Mm-hmm.
You are listening to the second program of the 2011 Traverse City National Writers Series on Interlochen Public Radio. Tonight's special guest is Sarah Brokaw, author of Fortitude, Making the Next Decades the Best Years of Your Life. Megan Raphael, the moderator of tonight's program, has just invited questions from the audience.
Don't be shy. Ask me anything. I'm pretty open about some things.
Okay.
I'm
not. Surely. I'll break the ice.
Thanks.
I was wondering, in the beginning you said when you started your research, you went to Darien and to Oxford, Mississippi, and I just thought of those two places as kind of having different women. And I just wonder if in all these places you visited, if you found that women are all the same or that they, you know, had different things to say. I know you said they all came up with the same values.
I think that's a fantastic question. Women obviously are not all the same. We have different upbringings, right? We're going to have different cultural beliefs or religious beliefs. But what I do know is that women truly are relational beings. They really are so eager to learn about who they are, and they also are in need of support from others. That's what I definitely notice. I also notice that women in their 30s really do have a little bit of anxiety about no longer being relevant. That's what I heard across the board. What was it about going into our fifth decade, into our 40s, that made us feel like we were no longer going to be relevant? And what was interesting also was that along with that fear came a lot of encouragement from the other women. There was a lot of support saying, you are relevant. It doesn't matter. You are relevant. You matter. That's what I know the common denominator. What I did know, if I can point out the difference, though, I think was about my expectations of certain women from where I traveled. I obviously walked in with certain assumptions when I would lead facilitate a discussion group with the women from Oxford, Mississippi, or the women in Provo, Utah. I definitely had an idea, or thought I had an idea how the conversation was going to go, and I was totally pleasantly surprised. I really was, and that once again, I had to practice humility, for sure.
I've noticed that I love watching old movies, because when I watch old movies, I kind of try and look at the messages that women were given back in the 40s, and I feel that those impacted then my generation later. And the movies now seem to keep showing young women getting drunk on their first date, and being totally drunk, and getting the guy in the end. And I'm wondering if you're seeing this is a cultural shift, and the message seems to be, if you're drunk, you're sexy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I personally think that the messages that are being conveyed in movies and television, I don't like the messages. I really don't. I think that it's not that I'm a traditionalist, but I also think that these type of messages are they're portraying women as either being really aggressive and really floozy or being really meek. They haven't figured out how to portray a woman who can actually be really strong and still possess femininity. They haven't figured that out yet. They really haven't. And I think we're going to get there at some point, but media or movies, I think that they feel like the only way in which they can get viewers or popular viewing is to portray women who's going to get drunk, you know, on the first date and then get the men at the end of the date.
Do you see this sort of being like a thing that's taking off culturally too, where I feel like our generation, well, for example, I grew up with glamour magazines and all that, and there was a certain way you were supposed to look in order to be sexy and attractive. Do you see this message getting through to the consciousness,
you know,
in a negative way?
Can't answer that, you know, with utter confidence, but what I can tell you is I started to notice 5 years ago, the only magazines that I felt could really cater to women such as myself, being 35, was More Magazine. All the other magazines really catered to women between the ages of, say, 20 and 32. And all the covers were really sexy, glamorous, sophisticated. With More Magazine, I didn't ever get that feel. I also didn't love the title, More. I just didn't. So I'm like, More? What, more fat, more wrinkles? Like, what? But what I've noticed, that there has been a slight shift, and I was really happy to see that. I think it was last August, and there were all these magazine covers, and all the women who were showcased were older. They were in their 40s. And that was on Cosmo, and it was on Glamour, and it was on Vogue and Elle. And it was, you know, the Susan Sarandon's and the Jennifer Aniston's and Sandra Bullock. And I was actually pretty pleased to see that. The thing that concerns me, though, are these women have a tremendous amount of money to make themselves look a certain way, to have their publicists portray them in a certain way. It's unrealistic. It's unrealistic. It's just, it's not possible to be like these women. It's just not. What is possible, though, is to be inspired by real women, women such as yourselves. And that was what I was trying to convey in this book. These women who you will read about, you will feel so inspired by them. And they didn't have the plastic surgery. They don't have the publicists. They're not sitting there blowing out their hair. They're not in these magazines telling about their, you know, their current romance. These are real women.
I just wanted to say hi to a neighbor. I lived in Mar Vista, California,
oh,
for
you?
20 years.
Love Mar Vista.
And my husband almost killed himself surfboarding, so he didn't have the same experience you had. But my question is, do you think it will take a female president of the United States to save us from global warming?
I think women can do everything. I think there's something to be said. I would love to have a female president. But let's be real here. I still feel like we're pretty much in an anachronistic society. We still have a long, long way to go. We really do. But I do think that women are very powerful, and we are definitely game changers. But with that said, I think that women really need to support each other. I think on one side, we're truly relational, but I think on the other side, we can be extraordinarily hard on each other. Am I wrong? No, I think that we can be extraordinarily hard on each other. And I think it's really about, if we really want to be the game changers and we really want to see women take more leadership roles and be powerful, then let's really team up. Let's stop competing with each other or being tough.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for coming up to Traverse City.
Oh, yeah.
I also was in New York City at that time, so I applaud your courage. That was really shocking. I'm a public speaker and a trainer, and I deal with 40, 50, 60, and I've just started working with the young women generation, and I've noticed that the messages that you talk about are running rampant in the young women of today, and the woman in front of me who talked about the movies and the messages that are going on there. So my question for you is, when you talk about women in their 40s and up, these are the mothers, these are the grandmothers, these are the people that our young women are looking up to, and these are probably the women that might be able to start the change in the young women. What one thing can we, as 40-plus women, what would be your message that we could trickle down to this young generation who are suffering, unbelievably suffering, because of the messages that society is presenting?
I think that's such an excellent question. I really do, especially because I have four nieces, you know, and one of them who's going into that sensitive age right now, like, you know, 18 to 20, and it makes me nervous because I'm starting to see self-doubt that she's experiencing as a young woman. I first believe that in order for us to effectively help these younger women, we need to take a very good look at ourselves as women who are 40 plus, feel confident with who we are. And to do that, we do need to incorporate those five essential values that I talk about in the book. Once I think that if we all can do that, I think it's going to be much easier to talk to these younger women, and the message will be that much more powerful. With media, I think that we're all struggling with it. How is it possible that we constantly hear about Lindsay Lohan and Charlie Sheen, but do people know what's really happening in Libya? You know, that's what bothers me, that the younger generation know exactly who's dating who, and I can't keep up, but who cares? Who cares? But that can't really change. You know, that's just going to happen. But what I do think, what we can do, is that we need to first foster these five values in our own individual lives and do it collectively, and then teach the younger women. But we need to first practice it before we can teach them.
So my question for you is, on the flip side of that, I'm raising a 7-year-old son, and I would like to know what the one thing I could do to help support him in loving a woman who represents everything that you just said. So what is it that we can do for our young men that we're bringing up as strong women to help them, love the women that we're...
Oh, wait, that's a really good question, and especially where it leaves me a little bit stumped, because my last niece, who was born 2 years ago, was the 15th girl in a row in our family. We have a lot of estrogen, so when the men who are in our family, they're definitely the inferior race, or gender, I mean, sorry, inferior gender. So, I mean, my dad can definitely say that. But what I would say is that men, boys, and I hope that men would agree with me on this, is that their pressures are going to be different. They define success or accomplishment through how much money they make. And I think that it's become increasingly difficult for men when they hit 40, especially right now because of the economic crisis. I think that a number of men, especially my male peers, I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but my male peers start to compare and despair with their male peers. The men who come into my practice start to really question their self-worth because of how much money they're making. And are we all questioning? And I would say, what I really like to say to these men is, like, women don't really think about how much money you're making. What they care about is your thoughtfulness. If you fill their tank up with gas, if you get them a flower, that's what we care about, just being thoughtful. And I think that men need to encourage other men that it's not about just money that defines a successful man. There are other ways. I don't know necessarily if women can teach that. I think that men can teach, but that men need to feel comfortable in having that very conversation. I think that's where we need to begin. I know that I'm glad to actually see some men in the room. I'm usually only talking to women. I'm so glad that men are here, because I think that it's now your responsibility, guys, to have this conversation with, if you have sons, nephews, if you're working in an environment where there are younger men, it's your responsibility to be their mentors, to help them navigate the labyrinth of adulthood, and to say that you're not only successful based upon how much money you make. There are other ways in which you can be successful. And I think that it's essential for men now to do that, especially during the economic crisis. As a 7-year-old, I think that it's the same thing. I think you can teach your 7-year-old, but I also think it's important for men around him to teach him as well.
Thank you for listening to An Evening with Sarah Brokaw. For more information on upcoming programs of the Traverse City National Writers Series, please visit their website at www.nationalwritersseries.org. This program was produced by Interlochen Public Radio. This is Aaron Stander.